Welcome to The Clever Cookster, your window into the kitchens of the world's best cooks. I'm your host, Kara Rhoda. This is a very special episode today, as we're kicking off a month of Clever Cookster podcasts guest-hosted by the author of the new book, My Mother's Kitchen, Breakfast, Lunch, Dinner, and the Meaning of Life, Peter Gethers. Over the next few weeks, Peter will be interviewing authors including Melissa Clark and Joan Nathan on this very podcast. Peter, welcome to The Clever Cookster, your new home.
Thank you. I'm already totally intimidated because you did that so well.
Well, I'm so excited to have you take over the podcast for a few weeks because your book captured so much of what I feel like is really important to me about food and cooking, how it can be therapy, a meditation, an identity for people, and its own language that allows us to say things to the people we love that we can't say otherwise. I'd love to just have you start by talking a bit about the process of writing the book and how those themes emerged.
Weirdly enough, it was an extremely easy process. It started as something else and evolved into what it ultimately is.
As the best things do.
Yes, exactly, as the way a good recipe evolves, not so dissimilar. But it really started out with where I decided to learn how to cook various things that I talked about with my mother. And then the more I spoke to her, the more I realized the book was really turning out to be about my mother. So what happened is she wound up giving me a list of her all-time favorite recipes divided into breakfast, lunch, and dinners, some of which were extremely simple, like matzo brei, which basically a monkey could make, and ending with things like salmon kulabiak and this incredibly complicated quail recipe, that both of which and several other things, like some of the breads, were way beyond my cooking capability. But what happened is my mother had had a stroke 7 or 8 years before I started writing the book, and probably 5 years before I really started to think about the book. And so what the book turned into was my really learning about my mother's past and, in fact, our whole family's history. And I realized that everything, weirdly enough, connected to food, and that every decision I'd made since my mother had become a kind of celebrated cook and cooking teacher and cookbook writer, which happened when she was in her 50s, everything that had happened to me that was important revolved around food. So basically, as I started writing and talking, I did learn to make the recipes, and the goal was to really make this fantasy dinner ultimately for my mother with all the people who loved her and all the famous chefs and food people who helped shape her and helped shape my life and my family's life. She died before I could get to that point, not so far before I could get to that point. And what happened, I learned so much about her and we became so much closer, although we were always close, that the dinner really turned out to wound up being her memorial dinner. And I cooked all these great things for 65 or 70 people, and people spoke about her. So it was the kind of loving dinner. It was just sort of after the fact. But it was very interesting the way it did evolve. It became much, much more personal, much more emotional, because what started out as somewhat distant became really a story about how food comforts you and helps you cope with grief. I can't actually say grief because my mother, who is an amazing person, died at 93, and she died after sipping a hot chocolate in her own bed, which I, by the way, would take tomorrow practically. So I can't say I grieved, but there's an extraordinary sense of loss.
You make a distinction in the book that I thought was so interesting between your mother's and your father's experiences with food towards the end of their lives. For your mother, near the end of her life, that perfect bite, whether it's the duck breast or the profiterole and the croque monsieur, is a reason to continue living. It's sort of that moment that makes everything else worthwhile. It's an experience so satisfying that it propels her through everything else that she's going through. And that contrasts with the way that you remember your father in the hospital with cancer, sipping this icy cold root beer through a straw and For him, it's more proof that he is still alive.
Correct.
And I found myself thinking about that point and how it sort of relates to different people's experiences of food. There are people who eat to live and people who live to eat. And I sort of wondered which camp you think you fall into and whether that's sort of something that you've noticed in feeding people throughout your life.
I definitely, that was extremely well said, and you condensed that whole point extremely well. It was very important to me and very interesting to me because I watched my mother soon after her, what should have been a paralyzing stroke that was kind of amazing that she lived through, and I watched her fight back to life over a lengthy period of time because she refused to give up. And one of the things that didn't desert her when speech deserted her and certain movements deserted her, she never lost her sense of taste. So taste became a real connection to her for life and a real reason to stay alive. And I do remember, and I write about this in my mother's kitchen, watching her eat a croquembouche that a friend of mine who's a great baker made. And I could see my mother, she was having to eat it with her left hand because her right hand was paralyzed and she couldn't get some of it off her chin because it dripped. And none of it mattered because what she really was saying is, this is why I will fight to stay alive so I can keep tasting this kind of delicious thing. Whereas, and I definitely fall into that category, unfortunately. I tell a story in the book that many, many years ago, when I was really young, I had a girlfriend who had, I'm trying to think if I'm exaggerating, and no, I'm not, the world's worst mother. She was just a nightmare. And I was trying to be the perfect boyfriend. I was in my early or mid-20s, and I didn't have very much money at all. And the mother was visiting her daughter, my girlfriend, she was coming in from California, and I decided to be the perfect boyfriend. And I took them out to a restaurant that was way too expensive for me. I mean, it was a week's salary, basically. And we had this lovely dinner at a little French restaurant in Greenwich Village, the three of us, and I ordered not the most expensive wine on the menu, but the most expensive wine I could afford. And the dinner was over, and I said to my semi-mother-in-law, so did you enjoy the dinner? And she looked at me and she said these words, and this is almost 40 years ago, and I remember this word for word. She just looked at me and she said, all food tastes like cold gray lumps of clay to me. I'd be happy if I never ate again in my life. And I just looked at her, and my first, of course, reaction was, well, maybe you could have told me this before I spent a week's salary. And my second reaction is, oh, my relationship with her daughter is never going to last, because if she has any semblance of that about food, it's doomed. So, and of course, it didn't last. But so that's so not me. I'm really not kidding when I tell you that since I was in my mid-20s, which is when my mother became heavily, heavily involved with food, she took a job at a great restaurant in Los Angeles, her first job ever, called Ma Maison, where the baby chef there was Wolfgang Puck. And my mother wound up, never having worked before until she was 53, she wound up really mentoring Wolfgang Puck and Nancy Silverton and John Waxman and that whole generation of California chefs coming forward to people like Dan Barber. And I realized that since she took that job and exposed me to that world, the things I've done for food are crazy, because every important decision, I once quit my job, and I was a reasonably high-powered publishing person, quit my job when I was in my 30s because I'd been in Paris and I was having oysters and mignonette sauce, and I just thought, what am I doing wasting my time working when I could be living in a place where I could eat oysters and mignonette sauce? And I wound up quitting my job and spending a year in the south of France. I bought a house, which I still own, a cottage. A house is a bit of a misnomer. A 180-year-old stone caretaker's cottage in the middle of nowhere, and I mean nowhere, in Sicily, because it's on the property of what is the best restaurant in Sicily. And so my whole life is geared around eating and drinking well. So I definitely fall into my mother's category.
A quick word from our sponsor. Did you know that saccharin was accidentally invented because someone forgot to wash his hands? Or that fondue became big after World War II because of a big cheese cartel? Is Alton Brown your spirit animal? If so, check out the funny and smart podcast, Hungry Squared, hosted by Sharon Titus and Winter Red, where they talk about the nerdy side of food. Food science, food history, and food design. Plus, they love doling out unqualified advice to listeners with food and relationship problems during their weekly food fight segment, like how to deal with the picky eaters in your life or whether you should eat dessert every day. We say yes. So check out Hungry Squared on Stitcher, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Their latest episode, number 38, features Anna Curran of the online service Cookbook Create. She talks all about the history of cookbooks and how they reflect who we are. By the way, did you know that the first known recipe for a hamburger was in a Roman cookbook from the 4th century? Crazy. Those Romans must have loved a good backyard barbecue. And now, back to the podcast. And your family's culinary history runs deep. Talk a little bit about Ratner's and what that was like as sort of a mythology and also a place when you were growing up.
Well, Ratner's, which doesn't exist now, and again, part of my mother's kitchen, it's a family memoir. I really think of it as more of a family memoir than a food memoir, although food is so central to the story. So I write about my family a lot, and I do have to say my mother's family, I can't say I write about them in a very complimentary way, as they ran Ratner's into the ground. But my grandfather, who was a wonderful, wonderful person, founded what became this world-famous Jewish dairy restaurant, Ratner's, on the Lower Side. He founded it in 1905. When it finally closed, I think it's 18 years ago or something like that, it was the longest continuously run family restaurant in New York City. And I can't say the food was high cuisine. I mean, you could pretty much literally feel your arteries start to harden before you actually got through an entire meal. But it was incredibly delicious, and it was real high quality, and it was sort of like eating in the past. It was a different era. It was very, very, it was great, great comfort food and family-oriented, and a lot of things there you could have eaten at the turn of the century. You know, it was that heavy Jewish food. And my favorite thing, too, are the waiters, who by the time I was a teenager and eating there really regularly, the waiters were so old that if you ordered a cup of soup, at most you got a quarter of the soup by the time it reached your table because they shook so much. And they wouldn't, if they didn't want you to eat what you ordered, they would just bring you something else. They were so cantankerous. So it was an amazing place. The culture of it was incredible. And you know, it completely shaped my mother's life, although she never worked there, and it really shaped mine because it was just such a connection to the past.
One of the things that I love so much about food is the way that it can be a portal and sort of a transportation into another time, another place, another era, another person's life. And one of the other things that does that is cookbooks. And cookbooks have been so important in your life and also in your mother's too. Talk a little bit about curating a cookbook collection and what you love about the cookbooks that have been meaningful for you.
It's really funny because so much of my life revolves around food, but I don't actually think of myself as a serious, serious food person, partly because as much as I love food and I love to cook, I don't have that perfect palate. I know people who, I know a lot about wine, but I don't have a great palate for wine, and it drives me crazy because people who know nothing about wine who are friends of mine will take a sip and they'll taste the dirt and the raspberries and they'll be able to say, you know, it's slightly off, and I'm going, it's wine, you know? So I just don't have that fine taste, and I don't have that magic cooking touch. I mean, if you had dinner at my house, you'd go, oh, this is really delicious, you're a good cook, but I don't have that super skill. And I work, part of what I do is I edit books for Knopf within the Penguin Random House group, and I do edit and have edited over my career a lot of cookbooks. And it's kind of weird because I don't know very much about recipes. I'm not really capable of looking at a recipe and saying, oh, you know what, this is way off. I think you mean a quarter of a cup of this. And I can't do that at all. But what I'm good at is shaping the direction of a cookbook and talking to the chef or the cookbook writer and sort of coming up with what the book should be about, really. I think of, I've edited a few wonderful, wonderful cookbooks, and the two that really stand out to me, only because of my contributions to them, one is a great cookbook, the AOC cookbook by Suzanne Gowen, and she's a genius, I think. And part of the way this book came about is I was eating at her restaurant, one of her restaurants in Los Angeles, and she asked me to try a dish, and I thought it was incredible. And she said, oh, it's really interesting because I decided I wanted to make this particular dish, but I wanted to add cinnamon, and no one would ever think of adding cinnamon to, I don't even remember what it was, but, and I kind of went, how do you know that? How do you do that? How do you develop that sense of taste? And more importantly, can you describe how it is you create flavors because of what you crave for taste? And that was really what the cookbook became. It became a book, even though it was a restaurant cookbook, about the nature of flavors and how you think about flavors and how you can't be afraid of trying different flavors. So that's what really interests me. Cookbooks interest me because somehow they wind up being part of my own personal pleasure. The other cookbook that I did, which is the complete opposite, there's a possibly the most eccentric restaurant in all of New York City is a place called Shopsons, which is now down on the Lower East Side in the Essex Street Market, but has moved around from place to place. And Kenny Shopson is a person who terrifies people because if he doesn't like you, he throws you out of the restaurant. And if you violate one of his many rules, he throws you out of his restaurant. And I've been in his restaurant where somebody violated a rule and he closed the entire restaurant down and kicked everybody out. So people are terrified of him. I have one friend who's banned for life from his restaurant. And I was eating there. I've been eating there for 35 years or more since I moved to New York, 40 years. And I talked him into doing a cookbook, just badgering. And it was really came about because he was such a wonderful person to talk to about food. You go to his restaurant and get him talking. He can talk about the repetitious process of cooking eggs, and he'll talk about it for an hour. And to me, it would be like listening to T.S. Eliot talk about poetry. It's extraordinary. And so that process was really, really fun for me. But I don't do cookbooks the way a real cook would do cookbooks. I do it the way sort of I envision it.
You talk in your book about how your mother thought of food in terms of menus, and I feel like dinner parties have such a notable presence throughout the book. What are some of your tips for putting together a dinner party menu and throwing the dinner party of your dreams? I feel like it's this aspiration that people have, and then they so often are disappointed in how it turns out, or they fail to pull it off.
It's something I genuinely think I was terrible at, because when I first really started cooking, the perfect dinner party menu for me would be pasta, potatoes, bread, and then dessert, because that's what I like to eat. And gradually, and I did learn some of this from my mother, and I've learned some of it from various girlfriends over the years, I've actually learned to almost set a nice table. I've learned to actually think about what goes together. So, in fact, you don't want to repeat starches and things like that.
I mean, I would come to the potato and pasta dinner any day of the week.
And by the way, that is still my fantasy dinner party. I just don't have the nerve to do it, well, except when I'm eating alone. And so now I learned to appreciate sort of the combination of tastes and that certain vegetables go with certain foods. You know, the same way, it's just a learned taste, the same way people always go, well, what wine do you pair with food? And I don't think there's any rule, because, you know, the standard old-fashioned is, well, you drink white wine with fish. Well, that's ridiculous. There are plenty of red wines. What pairs well with food is whatever tastes good in your palate. So it's the same thing I've learned with preparing a dinner party, except my palate has gotten a bit more sophisticated. So I kind of know what works for other people as well, because now it works for me. So I know there's the, you know, you don't, if I'm serving great wine, I don't have a really astringent salad, and I don't serve asparagus because it cuts into the taste of it. So, but it's really, there's no rule, because it's what tastes good to you. And I've learned that from working with all the cooks I've done cookbooks with. Lydia Bastianich is someone I've worked with now for a few years. And basically Lydia goes, if you ignore everything in my book, but the fact that you can't be afraid to cook, and you have to be so unafraid, you go, oh, I don't have this ingredient, I'll try this other ingredient and see what happens. That's not just the cooking, the secret to cooking, it's the secret to eating and putting together a dinner party. And, but yes, if I put together my fantasy dinner party, it would have, definitely have, I should never admit this publicly. There's no chance there would be salad. That would be out of the question. There would be one or two different pastas. There would probably be a fairly simple meat. My taste has changed over the years. I used to be a like fancy French food person. Now I'm much more bistro, or I like simple food much more than complicated food. I could eat sushi 5 times a week. I could eat raw fish constantly. I like it. So the secret to, I think, a perfect dinner party is really, really great wine and a lot of it, and really simple, delicious flavors.
Peter, thank you so much for coming to talk with us today. And I'm so excited for the interviews that you have coming up on The Clever Cookster.
Me too. I hope I do as nearly as good a job as you do.
Check out Peter's book, My Mother's Kitchen, Breakfast, Lunch, Dinner, and the Meaning of Life. And tune in next week on The Clever Cookster for Peter's interview with cookbook author Joan Nathan.